Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 5th, 2005. Today's session is entitled A Lutheran Argument for Gay Marriage, presented by Chris Sharon, session number SCC 2005-01. Let's listen in.
Discussion of the question of same-sex marriage from the Lutheran perspective, drawing on Lutheran theological perspective. Now, right off the bat, I ought to say there are probably many Lutheran theological perspectives, and so mine is one. And that's the reason that I've created this outline in the form of theses, not only because that's one Lutheran way of starting a conversation, to have a set of theses for a conversation or debate, but to make the point explicitly that these are proposals for conversation, as theses are, and not a definitive, conclusive perspective that can't be argued with. So right from the bat, I wanted to signal that. Now, I've had a number of opportunities to reflect on and write on these issues, starting when I was first in seminary in 1991, which was the year that the ELCA published Vision and Expectations, which was, at the time, a new document in the ELCA, and it outlined expectations for those planning to be in rostered ministry. And one of those expectations was the expectation that those who are, I forgot the exact language, but something like their self-understanding is homosexual, that they would refrain from homosexual practice. That was the language that Vision and Expectations used. And so I started seminary in the midst of a polemical moment in the church's life. The ELCA had just been formed, and a number of three seminarians at the seminary I went to in Berkeley were in the final year of seminary, and they said, "We've been approved for ministry, and it turns out we're gay, and we want to say that publicly." Well, that created quite a set of reactions across the church. Well, because of my beginning seminary at that moment, I was, whether I wanted to or not, caught up in the conversations, and I quickly met people and talked with people and learned the stories of people for whom this meant that they were facing either saying that they would remain celibate or leaving seminary or deciding that they would try and get through by lying or by keeping quiet. And that really disturbed me, because seminary for me was very easy, and no one asked me any hard questions because I was already married to a woman, and we had gone to Lutheran colleges and we fit the profile. No one asked questions about it. And so from early on, I decided that that gave me the possibility to speak about these issues in a way that didn't threaten me at all, but allowed me to raise hopefully some questions that the church could think about. So I wrote a book called Married in the Sight of God, which is on these issues, the Lutheran Church's struggle over issues of sexuality, and especially homosexuality, as it's been referred to in our church documents. And then some articles since then, including one in the Lutheran a year or so ago about this topic. And so this set of theses comes out of that research and writing that I've done. And I wanted to have more of a conversation, and so I'll go through these theses in a rather quick pace, and then you can come back to anything that I've said if you want, or we can talk about other things too as people join the conversation. So let me start with my first thesis, which is the Lutheran Reformation found means to overcome the church's rejection of marriage between a man and a woman as an unworthy place for Christian virtue, which may surprise some people, and by similar means has the resources to do so again in relation to same-sex unions. Let me just read a couple of sentences from Martin Luther's essay on the state of marriage, to give you in his own words how marriage was viewed during the time that he was working in the 1520s. "What we would speak of most is the fact that the state of marriage has universally fallen into such awful disrepute There are many pagan books which treat nothing but the depravity of womankind and the unhappiness of the estate of marriage, such that some have thought that even if wisdom itself were a woman, one should not marry. So he goes on and on and gives pages of examples of how people really disparaged marriage and thought of it as a secondary vocation. And I don't think in any way you could associate the views at that time in the Christian church as, quote, family values. It was very much celibacy values and monastic values that were appreciated. So Martin Luther overcame that, and I'm trying to pay attention to how he did that. And I think that can be of some help to us today. Okay, my second section, Clearing the Ground, is a couple of comments about why I think we ought to change our current teaching in the Lutheran Church. So thesis two just states our current policy and then states that we ought to rethink it. And because the ELCA itself has never formally passed a social statement that deals with sexuality, we still depend in an official way on the sexuality social statements of the ALC and the LCA. And so that's what I'm quoting from here, when our current policy still calls homosexuality a, quote, departure from and, quote, contrary to God's intention in creation. So why rethink that? Thesis three. Number, the content of those claims. They're clearly an argument from an intention in creation, an argument sort of like natural law, sort of drawing on biology. And so my argument is that if we're going to argue on those bases, then we ought to admit that science has changed. We're not living according to the science St. Paul understood, or even the science Martin Luther understood. We have a very different understanding of human psychology, human anatomy and physiology, and those understandings of science that we have today, I think, ought to impact how we make arguments about what's natural. Thesis four, there's a worry I have about the form of the arguments. Arguments from creation ought to reflect our sense that creation is not static, but unfolding, as is our understanding of it. Well, when people assert that there's one understanding of family ever, and it was embodied in these texts about the Garden of Eden and ever since it's been the same, they're implying that there's been a static understanding, one understanding of God-ordained family since creation. And careful historical work shows that's absolutely not true. And in fact, we wouldn't want to say it's true because we want to believe that God didn't just set up the world, as Terry Fretheim has been saying this week, God didn't just set up the world like a clock and then it started ticking through time with no more creative work and participation, but God is a creative God who participates and creates, and we're a part of that work of creatively participating in the world. So somehow to say that even something as foundational as family hasn't changed over time and won't change in some ways as we move into the future seems to me not helpful historically and not helpful theologically. Thesis five, context. Arguments formed in a crisis tend to be reactionary. Well, a famous early American Lutheran theologian named Charles Porterfield Crowth wrote a book called The Conservative Reformation. And he was writing a book about the Lutheran tradition. And there's two sides to our tradition, if you call it that, the Conservative Reformation. One is I think, something to be admired. We didn't throw out everything like some of the Reformation movements did. We didn't throw out stained glass. We didn't throw out music. So in that sense, we conserved some of the beautiful things from the Catholic tradition, the Mass, say, the order of the liturgy. And so in that sense, being a part of the Conservative Reformation is something that we can celebrate as Lutherans. But the flip side of that is, if you understand conservative to say, you know, we say no to anything new, any Johnny-come-lately. And the church too often does that. One of the classic examples that I was talking with someone about at lunch was the Catholic Church taking 500 years to come to grips with Galileo and its rejection of Galileo's understandings. And Luther, interestingly, had a very progressive response in relationship to what he understood was happening around sexuality and marriage. He didn't have a reactionary view, and so he made a possibility of a new moment opening up in terms of understanding what God was doing and could do in human relationships. But our Lutheran theology, again and again in this country, has made official pronouncements around sexuality at times of crisis, and so the work that's been done has often been reactionary. In the 1950s, Harold Haas wrote a book, a small book that was then used in official statements, talking about the heterosexual order of creation. And he was doing that in part because he was afraid of what the growing feminist movement would do to male and female roles in society. And he thought all of a sudden women would go to work and wouldn't be at home, and family would go to hell in a handbasket. And so he introduced this language of the heterosexual structure of creation, not to keep gays out of the ministry, but to keep women in the home. But then 10 or 15 years later, when Stonewall had happened and a liberation movement had begun among gay and lesbian people, there was a reappropriation of that language that Harold Haas used in Lutheran statements in the 70s in order to say, well, we're not going to let that happen in the church. You know, we're going to just say, you know, a married person can be at that time, a married man can be a pastor. So I think doing theology in a reactionary way often leads to bad thinking, bad theology. Instead of finding the space and the time to do something that's constructive and positive, we think, how can we stop that and find resources in the past that we can use for blocks in a wall to keep it from affecting the church? Then number six, the effects of the policy. Arguments that require lifelong celibacy of a whole class of persons are inhuman in the most profoundly theological sense. So our current policy says, for those who in their self-understanding are homosexual, they must be celibate in order to be pastors. Well, Martin Luther worked very hard to overcome the requirement of mandatory celibacy because he thought it was wrong. And he exactly, as I'll say in a minute, thought it was wrong because of the creation narratives where God created him and said, this is very good. And so by that teaching in our church, I think what we're saying to a whole class of persons is, you are not very good. That's what we're saying. And I worry greatly about that message that our church is sending. So those are reasons why, theses that make the case for why I think we ought to change the teaching that we have. Now a few theses on how constructive theological points might be drawn from Luther. And I'm drawing here primarily on his commentary on the book of Genesis, which unfortunately is not in the library. Volumes 1 through 3 are missing. I don't know why. But you can't check me on this, but when you get home, you can. So number 7, honor God's handiwork. Luther makes the case in dealing with the question of marriage that we shouldn't disparage men. Women shouldn't disparage men. Men shouldn't disparage women. Men and women shouldn't disparage the gift of marriage. Why? Because each of us is and only can be what God created us to be. And he draws from this creation narrative about being created in the image of God. And so there's this profound theological claim that what God has made is good. And what right do we have, therefore, to disparage it? Well, that, I believe, is something that we have to grapple with very seriously as a church. Are we willing to say to gay and lesbian people in the church, or not in the church, just generally. Somehow God didn't make you right, or somehow you're not made in the image of God. That's what we're struggling with. What do we say? And if we do say that all people are made good, that God has made them very good, then it raises interesting questions about what we ought to do then. So let's move along. Then the next thing, 8, Luther says, sexual desire is as natural as sleeping and eating. Luther's very earthy. How many of you have read Luther's writings yourself? So you'll confirm this for me, that he's very earthy. And he goes on to say, sleeping and eating, and then what happens to what you've eaten later. It's that natural. Sexual desire is absolutely bodily and natural. And each of us has to deal with the fact of sexual desire. He draws this from the Genesis 1:28 passage about be fruitful and multiply. He says God built into us this desire for one another. And if that's denied, it results in all kinds of negative things, a twisting of sexuality. And he gives lots of examples, and we could think of examples too. Well, he would have argued that meant that one ought not require celibacy, that people, by virtue of this natural sexual drive, people ought to have the possibility of finding a partner and sharing in a life with them, and as a part of that, sharing in a relationship that involved sex. And so, while Luther wouldn't have said this, if we have an understanding of gay and lesbian people as created good, and that this sexual drive is created in them as well, then it gives us pause, I think, to say somehow, and we do say this in the Lutheran Church officially, that we can say you're good as persons, but if you act on that, it's bad. And Luther says, no, you can't say that, because this desire that's built into us is a desire that God built in us. Why? For this purpose of desiring another. And so that leads me to the next one, Thesis 9. Marriage is a place of responsibility, Luther says. In marriage, the fundamental defining fact is the promises of fidelity that are given as and received. And one grows as a Christian in serving one's family as a nearest neighbor. And he draws this from Genesis 2:22, where God brings Eve to Adam. And so Luther understands that to be the first marriage, with God as the presider. And so there's this gift of a relationship, of a companionship, of a structure in which the sexual desire that God has created plays itself out. And so, likewise, if we say only certain people can have access to that relationship, that context in which sexual desire works itself out, and others cannot, what happens? Well, I think that obviously many people ignore that and commit to one another and live together anyway, but it denies something, according to what Luther's saying, it denies something that's fundamental about how we're built. We're built for relationship. We're built to desire one another and to commit to one another and to live together. So denying that denies something fundamental in God's creation and intention. Number 10, marriage is also a place of protection. Through commitment to one's partner, marriage provides the potential for trust and safety from the temptation to use others or let oneself be used, causing pain and rejection. So this is his response to sin. That although marriage is not always, committed relationships are not always a place of safety, they provide the context for a relationship of trust. And if they are that, then one can be safe with the other. And I think that potential, that promise of relationship, is a part of the reason why Luther encourages it. He calls it a bulwark against sin. It's a relationship that can not only protect us, but protect society. So, and that relates to the question of promising fidelity. Number 11. Considering such same-sex blessings forces us to rethink what it is when we bless marriages at all. It forces the question, what does God want for marriage?
Ooh. Somebody picked loud.
Oh, okay. They
That's
wanted
it
loud.
Want it so.
So, very often I think in our culture, marriage between men and women is so normal and so common that we don't really even think about what it is that Christians have to do with it and what it is that the God of Jesus Christ might want from it. It's a institution that's so integrated with cultural norms and with the interests of the state, so much so that when I preside at a wedding, I'm a surrogate for the state and sign a state wedding license on behalf of the state. So when we raise the question of same-sex blessings and relationships it in the church, and there's no, well, now there is in Massachusetts, but in the case of no state sanction for it at all, but people who are Christians and who are a part of our congregations and who desire for the community's blessing, it raises for us this question of what are we doing blessing all these relationships? And what is a marriage, fundamentally? And that, I think, is a really important question that feeds back through these theses from Luther about a way that a marriage, a committed relationship, is an imitation of God's promise of fidelity to us. That in making promises to one another, we imitate the promises that God has made to us, and we learn by living in that promise to live as God lives in this community of love that gives. And that, if that's the core meaning of Christian marriage, that promises are given and received, promises of fidelity for life, then it's something different than a relationship that's based, first of all, on procreation. If it's not, and this is a question that we can talk about, but my thesis is that it's primarily the promises of fidelity that Christian marriage is about, and that it imitates God's promise of fidelity to us. So all of these are arguments that Luther made in order to make space for a reinvigoration of marriage between a man and a woman as a Christian act, as something that would be a virtuous thing for Christians to do. And so my argument is that although Luther wouldn't have said this in his conclusions, the way he went about making those arguments helps us think about a way to make arguments about why same-sex marriage would be a relationship, a commitment that fits the kinds of virtues and values that we draw from this creation account in Genesis. And I think it's very important that those who want to find ways to support same-sex marriage draw on biblical and theological materials and not simply tell stories about personal experience. And I think that testimony is one of the most important things for the whole conversation. Testimony from people who have made those promises and live in a covenanted same-sex union. But if we don't do the work of going back to Scripture and going back to our tradition and saying how can this help us, and how does our understanding of the goodness of this relationship today make sense in relationship to our tradition, then only the people who are opposed to those kinds of changes will draw on scripture and tradition and will be seceding those sources. So I purposely don't give that up. But I also want to point out that I don't, in what I do, turn to the traditional texts in the Bible about, quote, homosexuality. And the reason is, first of all, it's almost always all that's done. And second, I think those conversations about those couple of texts in Scripture that deal with same-sex relationship keep us from talking about the question of committed relationships between same-sex partners. They stop the conversation from progressing to this. And so, although that's a conversation that can and does happen, it's not where I wanted to focus the conversation through the way I constructed the thesis. So I wanted you to know that I did that purposefully. I didn't do it by just sort of setting those aside. Well, that's the set of theses, and you can see that number 12 is blank, and it's blank on purpose because I recognize I don't have all the wisdom there is to have on this topic, and so that's my cue to open it up and to have some conversation.
Well, Chris, are you suggesting that Luther did or would condone homosexual marriage?
Luther did not in his writing. Like one of my teachers, Tim Lowell, did, if Luther could be in conversation with us today about our understandings of science and human experience today, I think he might. Why? Because Luther turned against tradition by paying very close pastoral attention to human experience and to people's suffering, and then read scripture in light of that, and found that he was able to say something different than what the tradition had given him regarding marriage. And he did not have a fundamentalist understanding of scripture. He described scripture as a wax nose that you can twist in any shape you want.
I don't think it's fair to put his name on it, but go ahead.
No, I'm not saying that he would. I'm just saying, based on what I understand of how he worked at his time, I can imagine it being possible.
Putting Luther aside.
What's that?
Putting Luther aside.
Yeah.
He's just a man, and
right.
His interpretation.
Right.
Did God create Adam and Adam? Did he create Eve and Eve? No, he created Adam and Eve. I think he had a purpose, didn't he? That's about the simplest thing I can think of.
Yeah, and so one of the things that that raises is, when God created two people, Adam and Eve in the biblical story, and intended for them this sexual desire that drew them together, that led to a relationship and that was generative and brought forth children and so forth, that relationship and that story is a story that we've used to say the only kind of relationship that's blessed by God is a relationship between one man and one woman in contemporary Lutheran conversations, just like you just described. Mm-hmm. And my argument is that even in Scripture, but especially across church history, there have been different configurations of families, not just one man and one woman. And those happen partly because of different cultures, and they happen partly because of different understandings of how to honor God. And so there isn't, in my understanding historically, only one model of family that's been associated with Judaism and Christianity. And I think we're in a moment now where we're learning new things about creation and about what human beings are. And so I'm saying that one way that we can take that story and have it be meaningful for us and true for us is to say, part of what God's intention was is that we should not be alone. Adam's plea to God is, I don't have one like me. There's no human companion for Adam. And so while most people are heterosexual and would seek out a partner who's the opposite sex. A minority of people have orientations different than that. And so my argument is that we can say God desired fidelity and companionship for people so that they're not alone, but have this opportunity to experience giving of themselves faithfully over their lifetime in love to another person, and that that relationship is generative for the community. Maybe not in terms of children, but maybe in many other ways, and maybe in fact as parents if they adopt. So that's my argument, is that that our contemporary circumstance asks me, how does this story and its truth connect with these people that are in our church community today, and their desire to express commitment and love for one another? So,
why didn't God create Adam, George, and Bob, and Eve, Julie, and whatever, and give them choice? Give them the opportunity to choose what they want to do.
Yeah, but I think what you're saying is that one creation story defines not only all of the creation material in the scripture, but also sort of a scientific understanding of human origins. And I don't read the creation narratives in the Old Testament as scientific descriptions of sort of human sociality or anatomy and physiology or psychology. I think they tell us about God's intentions for human community. And so it's not a simple thing. It's something that we struggle with. And I understand what you're saying. And, but I just think I have a intention at the heart of what I'm doing of thinking about those traditional texts in relationship to the Christian brothers and sisters I know who are already committing one to another and living together faithfully in same-sex partnerships. And how do I take this this story of creation origins and read about God's intentions there and have it make sense in relationship to these people today that I know and understand to be attempting to live faithfully as Christians? So, yeah.
I think your thesis three is so really very important about what we bring to the text.
Yeah.
And what we bring to the text in our personal experience, the witness of others' experience, and what we learn from other ways of getting knowledge. So I just, that's really, really important in your response to this question about Genesis 2. What do we think this, when I teach that text, I always ask my students, what question is this an answer to?
Right.
Right? And yeah, one of the questions that's oddly inserted in there is, why is it that a man leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife? And we think, but that wasn't the marriage pattern in that time period. There's some weird stuff anthropologically going on there too. So just always to remember, we read the text with more than the text in our head and in the room and in the conversation. And we're always having to figure out, not just on this issue, but many others, how does new human knowledge affect the way we read?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very important.
What we say.
Yeah, over here.
Homosexuality is not a new concept. It has been around since the written word. It's been around since, I mean, there's arguments to say homosexuality was apparent, you know, as early as 500 AD. And it's not a new concept. I just wonder what your thoughts are on why it's a new concept and why the homosexual community is demanding the validation of marriage.
Well, like Christian marriage, I think, which has been different and understood differently at different times, I think the word homosexual is new, but same-sex relationships of different sorts have existed for a very long time. And I don't think they've always been understood in the same way. In different cultures, they've meant different things and been different sorts of relationships. And the thing that I think is distinctive right now and that I'm trying to respond to is that brothers and sisters who are part of our churches understand themselves to be not primarily heterosexual. there's a range of kinds of sexual orientations that people understand themselves to be. And there's lots of conversations about what language to use about to describe those people. But one way to describe that is sort of minority sexual orientations, people who don't find themselves primarily attracted or desiring a person of the opposite sex. And they, because what we understand ourselves to be called to as Christians is those kinds of covenants of fidelity, then it's a very interesting and awkward thing, because on the one hand, people who are in the secular, quote, gay liberation movement or queer liberation movement are very skeptical of the church, very skeptical and dismissive sometimes with good reason, because the church has been very condemning of them. And so at the same time as Christians who identify that way are struggling to be in the church and live as, say, committed a couple that's committed to one another, they are caught between these two worlds. The church doesn't accept or bless or recognize that as an institution, although some denominations do and some congregations do. But the sort of gay and the queer liberation movement is skeptical of that too. So I think that's what I'm trying to respond to, and that's new. I think that kind of effort to publicly and faithfully live within a community centered on Jesus Christ and to commit to one another in a faithful relationship is new. And we're trying to grapple with that, and I think that our society is trying to grapple with new understandings of sexuality. I mean, Martin Luther thought women were half-baked men. I mean, that was his understanding of anatomy and physiology. He thought that there wasn't enough heat in your mother's womb, and that's why you came out a woman. And so you're sort of defective. I mean, really, there's just tremendously different understandings of what people are today, and we're trying to grapple with that.
And I think you bring up a good point, is you say that people have a problem with the current religious, I guess, promulgation of the church.
Yeah.
So they're trying to change it and evolve it and educate people. Well, I guess my point is that Martin Luther did the same thing with Catholicism, right?
Right.
So
on certain issues.
Coming from a good Catholic.
I'm Catholic. So, and in my mind, I mean, a sect was formed, and people joined together because they believe in the same thing. Well, here you come to another crossroad where you have two portions of the church. And yes, it's a small minority maybe that believes in this, but I think you're going to come to another crossroads again, and who's to say the church can't split again? You know, not to say that homosexuality is wrong. I by no means believe that. I think it's very, you know, I think there's some people who just, that's how they're wired. That's what they feel is right. But not to say that they can't go and form their own religious, Lutheran-based church and sect, and we can't respect each other.
Yeah.
You know, and if they're new...
Part of what's true today is that every religious tradition, every denomination has within it this tension about how do we as a denomination, as a religious tradition, respond to this question.
And I mean, I think...
So the Roman Catholic Church has big, big tensions around the same question.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think that's how reform is made. That's how new religions, new creeds are developed. And I don't think it's wrong for constituents to disagree with something. And there's nothing to say that that's wrong. It's just, if you believe one way, you believe one way. And if you're brought up to believe that the institution of marriage is for procreation, that's a very big step to say procreation is, you know, not necessary in this country.
It's a whole sideline, but the question of the centrality of procreation in Christian teaching on sexuality is a very interesting thing to look into. And why, at a certain point, generations after Jesus, procreation became central, even though it wasn't before that. So that's I want to get some other people into the conversation, but just to highlight that, I think that question of how procreation became central and why after generations after Jesus is a really important question in this whole discussion. Let's go Mark and then Mark.
I'm wondering if this prejudice against homosexuality, because I think it is a prejudice, is this, can we look historically on this becoming a civil rights issue a great deal, and perhaps the church going along with just a time frame? I know that the gay lesbian community is so anxious for action now, and they don't want to wait. Well, in civil rights with African American acceptance now, you know, and I don't know, you know, I can't figure out why the sexual issue is so volatile. I mean, it just seems like, hey, you know, just like a prejudice against African Americans. Well, come on, you know, what's the deal? I don't understand how we can overcome a prejudice like that. Why is, if someone is heterosexual, what difference does it make to them if somebody's homosexual? Duh. You know, why? It shouldn't make any difference. And I don't know how to get that across. It just drives me crazy. Yeah, I don't understand it.
What is the threat?
What is the threat?
That's a really multifaceted question I don't have an answer to, but lots of people have lots of different reasons why. And one of the things I think is really important to remember is how sort of absolutely connected culture and understandings of Christianity are. And so it's been very hard for the church at a stage where culture and Christianity agree on something to then accept change. Like, you can take the example of slavery in the South.
Yeah.
It was very integrated. The Christianity and the understanding of slavery as acceptable, and it's very difficult to break that connection in order to make change. So, Mark.
I think that one would add to your shrewd comments about how we have to adjust in view of changing scientific understandings of human nature and so on. I think the whole hermeneutical tradition on the reading of Genesis 2 also has to be considered. I mean, for instance, this is partly in response to the gentleman upstairs who was pressing you about, you know, why not George, Ralph, and Bill, and so on.
Right.
In some ways, I mean, the answer to that question coming out of Genesis 2 is that if you look closely at it, the problem is definitely loneliness. That's what God decides is not good. Not good that the earth creature should be alone.
Yeah.
And the next move in there is the creation of the Adams.
Right.
I mean, the first thing God does in response to the problem of the loneliness of the earth creature is to form out of the ground, same technique he uses to form the earth creature, the animals, and brings them before the earth creature to see what he would name them.
Yeah.
And the end of that whole process, which is a kind of you name and see if this works. No, I don't find a suitable companion there. I don't find a suitable companion there. And then I think the majority of scholars I read on that story thinks that then what happens is that human sexuality is created.
Yeah.
Then and only then. I mean, the status of Adam as male is very problematic. It seems to me that argument that you got a male there.
Yeah.
And so technically the answer to the question is why doesn't God create George, Bill, and Ralph? Is that it's the earth creature who says, yes, this will do here. None of this earlier stuff worked. I mean, I named the animals, but I don't have a suitable companion here. This companion is suitable for me. So in some ways, it isn't God who sort of by himself says, this is it. It's a kind of collaboration with the creation. And as long as that kind of relationship continues through history, it seems to me we have a big opening there with the creation of the animals in between, for saying that that whole process of negotiating what suitable companionship is something that goes on between the creator and the creature.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think exegetically that's what I found reading about that text. But if I look at it from the perspective of cultural anthropology, many cultures hold very strong binary opposites as a way to hold together their culture. And so they have very strict rules about what's clean and what's unclean, what's male and what's female. And you could almost describe distinct spheres. There's the sphere. Has anyone read The Red Tent? Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. There's like this sphere for women and this sphere for men. And when you have a culture that has such strong divides, it doesn't leave very much room for ambiguity. For like, well, not that exactly. Even though on the level of nature, we know that nature to be is much more complicated than that cultural bifurcation. And so it doesn't matter if it's our culture or other cultures. Cultures who have investment in that kind of binary opposition have a difficult time dealing with ambiguity. Now, there have been some cultures that have had privileged places for people who fit somewhere in between. And so I think that's a difficult question and maybe relates to the question of why this is hard to deal with. Because it raises for us the question of what do you do with exceptions? I mean, the fact is the norm is and probably always will be that males will be attracted to females and females to males. And so there you have it. But how do we deal with and respond to what amounts to an exceptional set of in-between categories? And how do we define them and how do we integrate those kinds of people? Well, it's the same in terms of size. We have an ideal size person or an ideal age person, and then we have trouble dealing with people who don't fit those norms. Mm-hmm. So it's a tough thing culturally, I think, to figure out how to include and be generous to and bless those that fall outside the range of normal. And in the strict sense of what culture defines as normal, not what's normal in the sense of good versus bad. So the cultural issue, I think, is a really powerful one to grapple with. Yeah.
Just a comment. I find it fascinating that those of us who think faithfulness, as Christians do, is such a virtue, are not rejoicing. In a world, especially in our culture where divorce is so common and not staying together is so common nowadays, that we aren't rejoicing when people are faithful to one another or when people choose to adopt children, for example, as many gay and lesbians do, children that nobody else will adopt, and they're adopting them. I just find it interesting that we aren't rejoicing in the fact that here are two people who want to be faithful to each other. And you know, in today's world, I think it's hard enough to stay married when everybody is going, oh, good for you, you're staying married one more year, let's support you. Imagine trying to stay faithful when you know people don't approve of you.
Yeah.
So I just think we're interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Other comments are back here.
I'd like to make a couple comments. Real early on, you, two or three good ways, used the expression reactionary. And more than once, but I'll just talk about this summer, there has been a marvelous visual display of what that can mean during worship in the village center. And the one that really struck me the best was when we had this huge horizontal cross made out of those old railroad ties from the Narrow Gauge Railroad. And several people came up and rearranged them into a wall, and then it made it like a box. And I thought to myself, this is what so many times in church history has happened, where something will come along that's new, perhaps in the culture or in the experience of people, particularly the time of the end of slavery. And the reactionary part is to build the wall and say, no, we're going to stop it right here. You know, it's way more dramatic than drawing a line in the sand. You're actually building an actual wall. And then the next thing you know, that wall is taken apart and formed back into the cross again when the acceptance comes. And I know for a fact, I actually met some gentlemen at one time when I was getting some eyeglasses, I think it was 45 years ago, 40 years ago or something, that to this day, or to that day, thought from their church that two things were absolutely wrong, and that's for any church to use music in any way at all, which I almost fell off the chair when I heard that one. But that slavery should have been continued because it was endorsed in the Bible.
Yeah.
And this brings me to the second part of it, and that is that there's a really big human problem, and not just Lutheran, but I'm talking about anybody who's in the realm of Christianity, Catholic, Protestant, whatever you want to call it, that we have a very human problem of not recognizing that the order of creation is that we and everything and all of the world was created good, but is fallen. And at the same time that we're fallen, we're also being redeemed. But what happens is, very, very readily, is that little voice from elsewhere gets into a person's insides, into their heart and mind, and says, if I can define the other, as not being up to expectations, not being fully qualified, then that makes me somehow righteous. Yeah. And that's a lie. And the thing is that we're all flawed, even the best of us, but we're all being redeemed all the time.
Yeah. That's a powerful message, and I think a very Pauline and biblical message about the danger of making oneself righteous at the expense of someone else. Joshua and Mark.
I think that one of the issues which makes this a difficult one for the Christian church, and specifically the Lutheran church, to grapple with, is that there are texts within Scripture that do speak to homosexuality, that do speak to a homosexual act between two people in a negative way. And I think that especially as Lutherans, we're proud of our tradition of sola scriptura and are quick to forget that we do have a hearty and robust tradition of interpreting Scripture. And that Martin Luther himself, as you mentioned, spoke of interpreting Scripture, or Scripture like a clay nose, that it can be bent. That we do pick and choose in Scripture, and we do let Scripture interpret Scripture. And the issue was much the same as we dealt with slavery and as we dealt with the role of women in society. We look to parts of Scripture that culture had that would support the current culture, and use that as a basis to discriminate. And I think that that's where we are now, and that we have to remain mindful that we do have a tradition of interpreting Scripture, and that Martin Luther, while promoted a sola scriptura model, very much understood that Scripture was changeable and was malleable.
Yeah, a long tradition of the church not really being willing to say certain people are good or fully human. We said that about women for a long time, that women weren't really as good or as human as men, and there are lots of scriptural texts that were given as evidence. So the question of how the Bible is authoritative and how we come to it in terms of our interpretation, I think that's really a key question, an important question in this. Because we have so many examples of Scripture being used to defend things we never would want to defend today for reasons that are commonly agreed upon. So yeah, Mark.
My comments are very similar to Joshua's, so I will condense them. What I really appreciated about these two spheres that you outlined, this cultural anthropological understanding, yeah, of how cultures do that, the sort of pure impure, you know, white black, good bad.
Yeah.
I think so often people want to use the Scriptures as a reinforcement or a bulwark within that structure, or as a way to make those distinctions even clearer. But I think just this week, tackling the text that, Terry has brought us, we can see how actually Scripture pushes against that, pushes against those easy distinctions, and actually pulls us. Scripture is countercultural. It pulls us out of the easy distinctions, out of the simple answers, into a more complex world. And I think interpretation plays a role there, but also just digging deeply and living deeply with the Scripture. And the other thing about sola scriptura is that Martin Luther also understood the preached word as authoritative, which involves necessarily interpretation and complexity and contextuality. So those are my comments.
I really think, and I'm trying to make the argument that the Lutheran tradition has a special giftedness for addressing these questions, and I don't think we've really embraced that in the way that we could, and that could be so fruitful for the larger Christian church. And I'm sorry for that. And part of the reason I think that that's true is because so often we've responded as a whole church body in a reactionary, fearful way, instead of saying, how can our tradition set us in a position to really speak in the most creative, positive word about our current context. So I hope that I can contribute to that sense, that we really have some giftedness to draw on. Yeah.
And I totally agree with that. And I think one of the things that, the big thing that makes me so proud to be a Lutheran is the ability as a Lutheran to think for yourself and interpret things and to be who you are, pray how you feel you need to pray, and there's no one telling you how to do that, but there's people embracing you and encouraging you and cheering you on. And to kind of go on the, you know, why aren't we embracing and cheering on these relationships, I think it goes back to also like how slavery, you know, it's the fear of the unknown, the unfamiliar, the, you know, what are we going to do if we don't have slavery? How is that going to be if we allow African Americans to be equal to us? You know, that's scary. That was scary to people back then. And I think right now people are battling. They don't know. They don't understand. They haven't. You know, I have a lot of gay, a lot of lesbian friends, and who, when people know them, it's amazing. You know, they just realize they're people. They're people. And it's not, I think they focus on the sexual piece of it instead of the humanity and the relationship piece of it. Yeah. Instead of realizing that these are two people that are joined together because they love each other. Yeah. It's much more than just, you know, a sexual act. It's people who love each other, and that's what we should be embracing. And we don't hear people crying out, the divorce rate's rising, and, you know, how come we married these people? They got divorced a year later, and, you know, nobody's arguing that point. I mean, how come we're not, you know, the divorce rate's just unbelievable, but yet we're not, like you said, we're not celebrating the love that other people have simply because they're of the same sex, which is very, very sad to me as a Lutheran, that we're even contemplating not allowing gay marriage or not ordaining gay and lesbian ministers. That's just very sad to me.
I think we're dancing around your number two issue. You believe number two to be true or false. I think that's the core issue, and we're dancing around it.
Yeah. I'm certainly willing to talk with people more, but we're at time for this hour conversation, and I'm grateful for all of you and all of the voices that contributed, and so thank you for coming.
Thank you.